Welcome to the latest edition of the Conversation Democracy 2025 podcast on political trust in times of COVID-19, produced by our digital partner, Content Group. My name's Mark Evans, the co-host of the podcast series with Michelle Grattan. Today, our topic is on trust, democracy, and COVID-19, a British perspective. Now, a week ago, the British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, announced that the number of people killed by the coronavirus in the United Kingdom stood at 32,313, the second highest death toll in the world. Health experts believe that the real figure is likely to be closer to 50,000. The number of deaths from COVID-19 in Australia currently stands at 103. And critics have accused a complacent British government of massively underestimating the gravity of the coronavirus. Even the prominent Italian newspaper, Corriere della Sera, reported that the situation in the UK was, I quote, like a nightmare from which you cannot awake, but in which you landed because of your own fault or stupidity. London correspondent Christoph Mayer writes, Britain has emerged as Europe's problem child of the COVID-19 crisis. Although international comparisons of COVID-19 death tolls are problematic, there can be no doubt that the lived citizen experience of COVID-19 has been dramatically different in the United Kingdom when compared with Australia. Every citizen has a heartbreaking personal story to tell. In contrast, most Australians have been fortunate voyeurs on the pandemic, further perpetuating its image as the lucky country. In this podcast, Michelle and I will explore differences in the management, experience, and impact of the crisis in the company of three leading British academic thinkers and members of the TrustGov project at the University of Southampton. I'm delighted to introduce to you, first of all, Will Jennings. Will is Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Southampton. He's an expert on public policy and political behaviour. He's Principal Investigator on the TrustGov project, co-director of the UK Policy Agendas Project, and elections analyst for Sky News. Welcome, Will. And then we have Dr. Jennifer Gaskell, who joined the TrustGov project as a research fellow in July 2019. She holds an interdisciplinary PhD in web science from the University of Southampton, and her research focuses on the ways new information and communication technologies impact civic and political participation. She's also the co-founder of BuildUp, a social enterprise working at the intersection of new technologies, civic engagement, and peace building. And then finally, we have Jerry Stoker, Professor of Governance at the University of Southampton and Centenary Professor at the University of Canberra. Jerry's an expert on democratic politics and governance, an advisor to governments and international organizations around the world on public sector reform. Many thanks to you all for joining us today. Let me begin with a question for Will. Will, tell us a little bit about the TrustGov project and your social purpose as an organisation.
Well, on the TrustGov project, we're really interested in understanding patterns of political trust and social trust across the world in different countries. We want to understand what it is that causes higher or low levels of trust in different national governance agencies or international governance agencies. It's obviously very pertinent at a time like now when citizens around the world are looking towards their governments to protect them. And they're also looking towards organizations like the World Health Organization to manage a kind of unfolding crisis. And so we're really interested in understanding what are the factors that lead people to trust or distrust those political actors and those international organizations. And another thing we're really interested in on the project is how people make those judgments about who to trust. You know, what is the information that people are looking for? Are they going on kind of pure measures of performance of, you know, how well the government is handling a crisis? Or is it something more effective about how they feel that the governments represent them or some other information? How do they relate to things like the media? And so we're really interested in grappling those questions on a really large scale in a very large number of countries. We've commissioned surveys surveys as part of the World Value Survey over 10 countries around the world and different sorts of regime types. So we're really trying to take the study of political trust beyond advanced liberal democracies, which obviously face certain issues around democratic distrust, to also understand kind of hybrid regimes and more autocratic regimes and understand what's going on there.
And of course, COVID-19 is going to allow you to test some of those fundamental assumptions around political trust. It's almost as if you wrote the script when you were writing the grant application, Will.
Well, I mean, it is strange how the political events can intersect and interfere with research projects. That when we developed the project with our colleague Pippa Norris at Harvard University, you know, none of us had heard of COVID-19, and the context was very different. We were living in a period, I think, of a feeling of kind of sense of democratic crisis. So, you know, in many countries, people kind of wondering what it was that had led citizens to lose trust in political actors. And at the start of the COVID-19 crisis, at the very least, we saw a rally in trust in political leaders, that governments, you know, the citizens look towards governments in a more positive light. And so it's been a strange time to be studying political trust. But I think in some of the normal rules of political engagement seem to be being re-engaged across the world. And so we've gone through this kind of rather strange period, but it feels like we're back into a little bit more of a normal period for political trust now and in the months ahead.
Well, I think that might be a key contrast with what's happening in Australia, because at the moment, Scott Morrison is maintaining his high approval rating. So look, I'm going to hand over to Michelle now to ask you some questions around the issue of declining political trust. Michelle.
Thanks, Mark. Jerry, could I start with you, and could you delve a little more into this concept of political trust? What do you understand by it?
Political trust has been one of the central elements of thinking about the way that politics works. It's fundamentally about the relationship between a citizen and governments or politicians. So it might be about their attitudes or their sense of judgment in relation to a politician or a political institution, whether that be parliament or the executive or some other political organisation. So political trust is about that relationship, whether people trust the political actor to do something. That's the other crucial element of it, which is that it's about not just whether you trust them in general, but whether you trust them to do something specifically. So, for example, I might be quite happy to say I trust my government to deliver an effective refuge collection system, but I might not be quite so happy to say that I trust it to deal with an issue like climate change. So we don't expect governments to have kind of across-the-board trust, and we also expect that trust to vary over time. So trust is really one of the core ingredients in making the relationship between citizen and government.
Will, we're focusing in this discussion, of course, particularly on the UK. What does the data tell us about trust between government and citizens there?
Well, I mean, across the whole kind of field of trust research, there's this whole debate around whether distrust of government is rising or whether it's a kind of just random fluctuation that varies from year to year depending on political events. And some of the data that we're looking at in surveys like the British Social Attitude Survey, we do see rising levels of distrust of government among different groups of citizens. I think often there are a focus on particular demographics that might have kind of higher or lower levels of distrust. But in the UK over the last 30 years, there is some evidence that distrust of government to do the right thing, to kind of, you know, kind of act honestly, and for British politicians to act honestly, has that kind of distrust has been rising. And so we see a trend there that is concerning, I think, for those of us in advanced liberal democracies, where the idea of a kind of having some sort of reservoir of political trust among citizens that the government will do the right thing is actually really important for the operation of politics.
And what's the latest data that you have?
Well, the interesting thing about the kind of COVID-19 crisis is that initially there was what's being described as a rally around the flag, that trust and confidence in the government rose in the early weeks and months of the COVID-19 crisis. So citizens look towards government and the Prime Minister here in a non-partisan way. And in the UK, we had this strange period where the Prime Minister was very ill and people obviously were worried about him, which maintained high levels of support and trust in him. But what we've seen in the last few weeks is a real kind of unravelling of those higher levels of political trust in how the government's handling the crisis, which is not unrelated to actual you know, performance. You know, I think one of the things you can talk about political trust and forget that, you know, that citizens are making judgments based on the world around them. And what's been happening as we've had a very high death toll here, there have been some quite serious questions raised about how the government handled the crisis. Is that those sort of elevated levels of trust and confidence in political leaders have been declining and really are almost back at the level that they were before the crisis began.
So, Jen, if I could turn to you, why does trust matter, and particularly what sort of situations does it matter most in?
Well, more generally, why trust matters or declining levels of trust matter is not yet very well understood. There still needs to be a lot more research on the consequences of political trust and political distrust. But we're seeing, for example, in the case of COVID-19, at least here in the UK, that whereas, you know, the initial phases of the lockdown, which was quite strict, you know, the levels of trust among the public might not have been the primary factor in, you know, inducing compliance. Recent events, which, as well just mentioned, have sort of damaged that public trust in the government and politicians, are showing early evidence of, you know, increased lack of compliance with the new measures. So I'm thinking, obviously, particularly about the Dominic Cummings affair of him allegedly breaking the rules of the lockdown in April, but also the lack of consistency around the easing of the lockdown. The UK still being at alert level 4, which, you know, was originally described in the roadmap out of lockdown as, you know, requiring continued lockdown. We're now still at level 4 and not at level 3, but we're easing the lockdown still, and it's making people really uncomfortable. And the sort of mixed messages from the government means that we're seeing evidence of people not complying at all with either lockdown rules or social distancing guidelines, which potentially can have, you know, a severe impact. In the longer term, you know, the evidence from our work as well shows that compliance with you know, contact tracing apps, for example, take up of contact tracing apps and immunity testing will need some public trust, or at least low level of distrust of the government. And there's been previous research in Germany that showed that after the swine flu pandemic of 2009, a lack of trust in the government and scientific and medical authorities meant that there was very low uptake on the vaccine that was, by all accounts, very effective and safe, because people didn't believe that these authorities, you know, had their best interest at heart. So it is quite important.
So people really take their wider suspicion of government into their views on specific measures.
Yes, it does. Early work seems to indicate that, and it's more important in the sort of mid to long term elements of compliance. For example, in the UK, the government has been sort of quite keen for schools to reopen, but a lack of trust in the fact, in, you know, in the health and safety of this reopening has meant that both many schools across the country have refused to open, and a lot of parents are refusing to send their children back to school as well.
Back to you, Mark.
Yeah, so look, let's compare the UK situation with Australia now. So Jerry, as we noted earlier, there's been dramatic differences in the lived experience of COVID-19 in the UK when compared with Australia. Everybody has a personal story in the UK. How far has that impinged on the politics?
I think it is impinged a lot precisely because it's not only an issue which people have been observing or looking at through the media, a kind of story they're following. It's been a real lived experience, both in terms of the decisions that people have had to make to protect themselves and their own families, but also the number of people that have family members that are engaged directly in providing healthcare services, social care services, having to take different kinds of risks themselves in order to deal with the pandemic. And the scale and size of the number of deaths, I think, has become a matter of considerable concern within the country itself. And I think after an initial phase where probably, as Will was arguing, there was a kind of surge of trust, as he described it, a kind of rallying around the flag. And to be honest, also a huge amount of civic commitment and effort as well, as people out of just nothing made extraordinary efforts in communities to find ways to help people who couldn't get shopping, help people who couldn't get their medicines, provide all kinds of community support, and even contacting people who just were on their own and needed to have conversations with people. There's been a tremendous volunteering effort and a huge amount of social solidarity showing. So the positives, I think, are there to some degree, but increasingly people are focusing on the negatives. It appears that there are and have been significant failures in our governance system, perhaps long-standing weaknesses in our governance system, an over-reliance on Westminster, an over-reliance on Whitehall, a kind of almost staggering scale of arrogance among some of the decision makers at that level. And I think the long-term implications for a system which is clearly demonstrated at the very moment it sees citizens most needed, a huge capacity for blunder and failure, I think are going to be very significant indeed, and will open up, I hope, a much more significant commitment to reform about democratic processes and governance processes in the UK, because if this isn't a wake-up call, I'm not quite sure what would be.
And do you think there'll be a more sort of active citizenry as well as a consequence? I mean, there's been this sense up to now that, you know, we've kind of focused on government solving our problems. But it seems to me that we're seeing communities take the initiative themselves. Do you think we're starting to see the emergence of a new type of politics?
Well, I'm going to give a classic academic answer to that, which is I can see some elements of that, but I can also see some big issues with it. There's definitely a sense in which a whole range of people have found community connections and a willingness to volunteer and engage that hasn't existed before. But equally, a lot of the sustainable long-term capacity in the community and voluntary sector is seriously in doubt. There are many charities and many community organisations that have just not been able to fundraise over the last few months. We've done a survey of the local organisations in the area where I live, which is Dorset, and we think that up to two-thirds of voluntary community organisations will actually go bust in the next year. So It may well be that there's the community willingness there, but whether there's the community infrastructure to support that, I'm not so sure. And then if I'm talking more broadly about democratic engagement, I think that there has been increasing sense of engagement and interest in politics, weirdly paralleling the decline of trust. But perhaps you could obviously explain that by saying the reason why people are getting more interested is because they think politics is more and more useless. But I do think that one of the biggest challenges facing anyone that wants to kind of engage in politics is that they're going to face much more pressing issues in their daily social and economic lives, not least increasing evidence of large-scale unemployment, which is going to drive people to focus on the economic necessities rather than necessarily think this is the moment for them to spend more of their free time engaged in politics. So I think it's a complex issue. For me, I'd want to look to citizens to engage a bit more, but above all, I want to see political elites finally addressing the increasingly obvious evidence that our system does not work.
So Jen, I know you have some survey data to share with us on the government's management of the virus. Overall, how has the British government fared?
Well, there's been some sort of mixed track record here. The government has been praised in his support of workers through the furlough scheme and other financial economic support to people who are having employment difficulties. But in other areas, it's been heavily criticized in the early days for, you know, implementing the lockdown perhaps too late and too slowly as compared to other countries in Europe and the rest of the world. There's been a few different scandals in terms of masks and protective equipment and its testing capabilities or lack thereof in the early days. And in spite of all of this, as Will mentioned before, there's been a bit of a rally around the flag effect at first, where the government got sort of increased support and it seemed to, citizens seemed to, you know, forget their other divides or differences. But after that started to decline before Boris Johnson caught COVID and has been declining quite sharply ever since. So our survey data show that a majority of people believe the government isn't handling the pandemic very well. And I think that's been, our survey was in the field on the 18th and 19th of May, and that trend has accelerated since from recent polls that have come out in the news. I don't know if Will, you have more, you want to add anything on the early results that we've got?
I think from we've conducted early survey work and also a few tentative focus groups around how people are kind of experiencing the crisis and their views towards the government. And I think one of the really interesting things of working in this area is that people's expressed views in surveys often don't get entirely at the sorts of feeling they have towards government. So we've done a few kind of pilot focus groups with citizens. And actually there are quite implicit levels of trust in government, despite the fact that we've seen quite big fluctuations in that initial rally around the flag and then declining trust as the government's performance has kind of, been kind of coming for scrutiny. When you actually ask citizens, you know, their attitude, they see the politicians and the government as having a really thankless task. But they also kind of think that they have actually kind of quite underlying positive views of that the government is there trying to do a job to protect them. So I think there's something really interesting going on there in terms of how people form their trust judgments. And I think the real, really big question for us in the UK, but also in other countries, is how those two things, that kind of implicit trust in the political system, government to look after you and protect you and secure you, will kind of come into dissonance with actual evaluations of performance once we get more information about how the crisis was responded to, the sorts of scientific evidence that was given at the start.
And the National Health Service seems to have coped pretty well. Incredibly well, given the numbers that we've been talking about. Look, the Australian media has been quite quizzical about why British people were so outraged by the Dominic Cummins affair. Jerry, what would be your response to that?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable that they find it quite difficult to comprehend why what would on the surface be quite an obscure person, policy advisor or political advisor within Number 10, somehow attracted such a large amount of attention. There are probably important background factors, undoubtedly, both in reality and in drama portraits on British television. Dominic Cummings was seen as a person who played a very significant role in the whole row about whether to leave the European Union or not. So he had Brexit credentials, which were in lots of people's heads before the start of the argument and the row. But I think that the row itself reflects the point that Will was making earlier on, that sometimes people make trust judgments on the back of judgments about competence, but sometimes they make it on much more emotional and or moral grounds as well. And I think that's the reason why people felt so much outrage, or rather a substantial majority of the population appears to have felt substantial outrage, is that many people had made what they thought were decisions on the back of the guidelines provided by the government, and they all thought that they were doing this in order to help the whole of the rest of the community in order to follow those guidelines. So people have not been to see their loved ones, even though they were dying in hospital because they were told to stay away. They've not been able to attend the funerals of those loved ones. They've not been able to attend sick children. They've not been able to visit with their grandchildren, and so on and so forth. So lots of people felt that by following the guidelines fairly rigorously themselves and staying at home, they had actually done exactly what the government asked. And it turned out that a senior government advisor completely ignored the guidelines. I suppose I'm supposed to say allegedly now, but I can't see how, if you look at any objective version of the guidelines, you can say other than that they were broken perhaps not just once, but also potentially twice. And I think the outrage is because people think, well, we made this commitment, we made this effort, we made our decision to sacrifice in order for achieve a public benefit, and then a senior figure advising the government seemed to have had an ability to ride a coach and horses through those guidelines. I think you can understand, especially at the end of a long period of sacrifice, why people would be very, very angry with the fact that somebody just seemed to do it, and to do it in a way that kind of was quite blasé in the way that they ultimately responded to the challenge to them. It was only ultimately when they did the press conference that they offered any explanation as to what it is that they'd done. Up until that point, Dominic Cummings had just simply uttered to people, it's none of your business, go away. I don't know. I would have said that if most Australians had lived through that, and as you make the point, the difference between the lived experience of people in the UK and the lived experience of people in Australia is massively different. If you'd lived through what we'd lived through in Britain, you would be flipping annoyed if some jumped on political advisor to seem to think the rules apply to you, but they don't apply to them.
But also clearly another example of government communication failure as well, in terms of how the whole issue was communicated and managed.
Yeah, and also plays massively to the one rule for us, another rule for them. Quite hilariously, in some ways, given that a lot of the Brexit campaign was all about some division between the them in Whitehall that wanted us to be friends with the European Union and us back in Britain that wants to be autonomous and all on our own, etc. It was hilarious in some ways that Dominic Cummings, the author of a lot of that kind of language, actually got stung by himself.
So other journalists in Australia are arguing that we're witnessing the slow death of the union now. Will, has COVID-19 further weakened the union?
Well, one of the really interesting things about COVID-19 in the UK, but it has been about the differences between the devolved nations of the UK, between England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland to a lesser extent, because it's really exposed the different powers and competencies of those devolved administrations, the different politics. And that's also true actually of regional authorities as well, you know, kind of the Manchester mayor and so forth, because what has happened is that we've seen quite distinct Responses to COVID-19 in the devolved nations. There's been talk about the Welsh police basically sending people back into across into England, saying, you know, don't bring your COVID-19 here. You know, on kind of day trips and so forth. And the Scottish First Minister holds her daily briefing alongside that of Number 10, and has been widely praised for. Or kind of at least has been seen good ratings in terms of how the crisis has been handled in Scotland, despite the fact there are questions there about it has been handled. And so it has really shown the distinct political experiences and policy experiences of people in England, Wales, Scotland. And I think that in that sense, it has maybe perhaps not weakened the union, because I think the union was already fraying, but it has really exposed that we actually have a properly devolved system of governance that people often forget and like to kind of ignore. And actually the UK government is dealing with the problem in England, and a lot of the issues that Boris Johnson is facing are to do with England, and the devolved nations are handling things differently, making different decisions around schools, sometimes relying on different expert advice. And so it really has shown that some of the assumptions we have about British politics often, you know, come out the window when faced with reality.
Mm. So there's some similarities there to Australian federalism and the role of states and territories. And it's really interesting that you noted how well women leaders are performing in the management of the COVID-19 crisis. So look, Michelle's going to ask you some questions now on the impact of COVID-19 on international relations, democracy, and public policy. Michelle.
Jen, let me start with you. COVID has obviously heightened the tensions between China and the United States, and indeed between China and Australia. Where do you think the pandemic leaves international relations at the moment?
Well, I think that it's obviously a huge challenge to the way that international relations have been organized to date. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's a cause of the existing tension, but it's definitely accelerated them. I mean, tensions have been evident, you know, for a number of years now. But the pandemic is an illustration of some of the risks, you know, of a globalized world. And many think that, you know, this is a time for to put up a united front, you know, against the threat, and this is clearly not happening. I mean, we've seen tensions, as you say, you know, over, you know, global trade with supplies of masks and protective equipment containers being stopped, diverted around the world. And there's obviously borders have closed, you know, they're starting to reopen. But it's unclear at the moment, you know, what the threat level is going to be going forward. So, you know, it's not hard to imagine that borders might have to close or reopen at different intervals and times in the future. And how that is governed, you know, is still unclear. And at the time where, you know, global and international consensus should help fight the pandemic, this is clearly not the case. Another issue that's been severely affected is global governance institutions. So, you know, the World Health Organization is struggling to leverage this sort of, you know, global cooperation effort in fighting the crisis. And, you know, it's quite early days to know how it's all going to pan out. But I think all the evidence points towards, you know, now being a critical time in the future of international relations. We're not clear at the moment, you know, about the level of recession that we're going to live through and we're going to face. And this is also going to affect, you know, budgets in terms of global aid, international development, supports to, you know, conflict affected areas. And it is quite worrying.
And you would think it would contribute to protectionist pressures rising, wouldn't you?
I mean, at the moment, this is, you know, all the evidence points towards that. So sort of, you know, abandoning, you know, previously agreed norms of international cooperation, you know, protect national interest.
And it's also given President Trump more reason to mount a campaign against China and use that domestically.
Yes, absolutely. Although at the moment he's having some trouble on many other fronts. So,
well, that's certainly true. Jerry, how has the EU fared in all this?
Well, I think on the whole, it's come out a bit in the classic EU manner, which is it's just kind of managed to effectively muddle through again. Obviously, the different experiences of different European countries, with Spain and Italy having devastating experiences under COVID-19, other European Union countries perhaps either been luckier or more effective in their management of the virus, or perhaps been able to react because they had the experience of Spain and Italy to look at, have emerged as individual countries slightly better. And although there's been some tensions within the European Union, not least over the bearing of costs in relation to COVID-19, I think there's already some signs of some sharing and some solidarity there within the European Union, and also increasing signs that the Germans have begun to reassert their leadership over the European Union. Particularly Angela Merkel, I think, is beginning to have conversations within the European Union about how to provide financial and support mechanisms more widely. So although I think that the challenge in individual countries has been very, very significant indeed, the European Union, I think, has probably effectively found a way through and is likely to almost build on the level of solidarity shown thus far between European Union countries.
Will, coming back to the UK, do you think the operation of democratic institutions will change as a consequence of COVID, the experience of virtual House of Commons, for example?
I think it's almost too early to tell. I think as we were discussing around devolution, I think what COVID-19 has shown is that there are there is a kind of multi-layered or fragmented polity in the UK with different centres of power and different political actors who can innovate, can take leadership and respond to policy challenges. So on that ground, I'm not sure we'll see a massive, huge change, I think, in terms of further decentralisation. I think we have a long history of failed attempts to actually give power away from Whitehall and Westminster. But I think it certainly has shown the real kind of pressures on the UK's political system and the issues it still faces. I mean, in some ways, talking about the kind of the virtual House of Commons shows in some ways the real limitations and the kind of the failures of British politics to move itself into the 21st century, because just in the last week we saw an end to the virtual voting and a kind of return to physical voting in the House of Commons. Which I don't know if you saw the images of the kilometer-long queues of MPs going to vote, which were much derided and showed really, you know, kind of what an impractical measure this is, going back to physical voting in the days of social distancing. And we had reports yesterday that one government minister had to self-isolate because they'd shown symptoms of COVID-19, showing that really it was quite a self-indulgent act to return to physical voting, because it was putting MPs at risk. It had excluded MPs who were having to shield because of health conditions or health conditions of family, which seems in many ways to be completely out of step with the time in terms of the how government's responding to the crisis. And so while we have this little glimpse of the fact that we can do democracy online, that we can govern ourselves online, that voting can be done digitally, there is still a very instinctive reflex in British politics to fairly antiquated systems and measures, even when people are saying this is a bit ridiculous, really, you know, maybe we should update things and do things differently.
Well, do you think that some people think that there's very much of an overreaction because you had Parliament meeting when bombs were being rained on London, for example?
I think in one regard, part of the resistance to changing to do things differently is a kind of fear over what that might do to power. I mean, there's been a whole question about how party whipping systems operate in the days of digital voting, that you can't kind of strong arm people, push them into a corridor and kind of sternly get in their face to say you're going to vote with the government.
You need to shirt front them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't do that online. You know, you can kind of hide away, and yet if MPs are in their home constituencies, they can just turn the WhatsApp off and go into the garden and click a button and you've rebelled. And so I do think there is something, you know, at a latent level in the way that kind of governments and parties operate that has slight fear of the virtual forms of doing parliamentary and legislative politics, because it actually gives freedom and latitude to legislators to do what they think is right and not have access to those kind of traditional sorts of tools of political control.
Jerry, can I ask you how this has affected the broad policy debate? What issues have come to the fore, and have you found, as in Australia indeed, that some issues that people were talking about have just gone completely off the agenda?
I think that initially, it's fair to say that the only issue on the agenda was how to deal with the pandemic, and that knocked every other issue off the agenda. I do think that in dealing with the pandemic, there are some underlying issues that have emerged. I think it's fairly clear that there are substantial challenges around the issue of the way that procurement works and operates within the British government system. There's clearly massive problems about communication between different levels of government, which I think seems to have kind of emerged as a constant issue. There's a significant issue about the way that money is spread within the system. And also, I think probably the long-term failure to deal with issues within the social care system has also, I think, been directly highlighted by the pandemic itself. Earlier in the conversation, we were noting, I think quite rightly, how much praise people within the NHS need for the work that they put in helping people through the pandemic. But I think part of the reason why the NHS has actually managed to survive is because we actually pushed an awful lot of patients and people out into a social care system that was underfunded and unprepared. And that reflects in the number of deaths that are then occurs within care homes and or in people's own homes as well. So I think that the future of the social care system is something which is directly, I think, become highlighted in the context of the pandemic. For other issues, I think issues that relate to, in the UK, climate change, Brexit, dealing with a major economic crisis, they are already beginning to resurface on the agenda. And it's possible that some lessons will be drawn from our experiences during the pandemic in relation to those. So I agree with you, Michelle, that in the short run, it's pushed everything else off the agenda and maybe given us a prominent focus on the issue of social care. In the longer run, I think these other issues are already beginning to emerge back on the agenda.
It doesn't take all that long. Back to you, Mark.
Yeah, so look, a final question for all three of you. Could you identify one intervention that you think could make a big difference in bridging the trust divide between government and citizen in the UK? Let's start with Jen.
So I think I know Will is sceptical, but I think empowering local authorities to be able to better deal, you know, with kind of sort of the relevant for their own areas, the relevant aspects of the pandemic would, you know, increase trust in authorities and the broader government. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that, local governments are more highly trusted, that people trust people that are closer to them, that understand, you know, the issues of their communities and the needs of their communities, which are widely different, you know, across the country. And so to me, that would contribute, you know, mid to longer term to restoring some levels of trust.
So kind of a community-driven kind of development model where communities develop their own way out of the crisis.
Yes, well, within a democratic model, so I'm thinking about local authorities, you know, elected local authorities with the legitimacy to, you know, to manage their own issues, as I said, which are widely different, you know, in different parts of the country. I think early evidence from our focus group shows that, you know, having people who understand, you know, where you're from, what your problems are, what your issues are, you know, are very important, you know, to citizens. And that would be a way, you know, to make the message sort of more coherent, but also more relevant and applicable, and therefore, you know, more consistent in terms of, you know, a way out of this crisis.
Absolutely. Will?
Well, I mean, I think there is a lot to be said for addressing how power is distributed in the UK between, you know, Whitehall, Westminster, and the rest of the country. And I think there are big questions there about how we organise ourselves and give power to regions, to devolve governments, and as a way of kind of filtering down. I mean, I do think that this crisis also exposed the limits of how we do politics in terms of people fronting up and say when they got things wrong, or, you know, when things are complicated. Because I think, you know, actually citizens are not stupid. They understand that something like dealing with the pandemic involves tough decisions, difficult decisions, uncertainty. And they understand that. And I think the relationship between citizens and rulers would be better if we were able to have an honest conversation about, like, we got things wrong. Because I think in the UK, there was clearly an issue around some of the nature of the scientific evidence that we faced early on that pushed us in problematic directions. I think that put us on the wrong path. And there are a history of decisions around how we're governed that have hollowed out the state, that have left it without the capacity and the resources to actually address those issues. And yet, you know, politicians and governments aren't able to have those honest conversations to say to people, well, look, we haven't handled it as well as we'd like, but these are the reasons why, and we want to learn and do better. And I think the nature of our politics means we're not able to do that. We're not able to have those conversations because it's seen as too partisan. And so I think if we were able to shift politics to a way where we can actually talk about learning and doing things better, and that's not to go down the technocratic route, but it's just to say, you know, it's tough, right? We live in a complicated world with, you know, huge challenges, of which COVID-19 is just going to be one. I think that will be a huge step to us actually being better governed.
Yeah, that's a powerful insight. And Jerry?
Well, Mark, I want to say straight away that I agree with both Jen's suggestions and Will's suggestions. And I'll simply add that I think in order to make progress on both of those suggestions, the other thing we probably need above all is the political and administrative class, especially at the national level, to address its utter and complete failings to deal with complex governance challenges. And that's about the structure of those people who are attracted to top jobs in politics and the types of people who also emerge as top people within the civil service itself. And I think that what the COVID crisis has shown more than anything is this perpetual, ridiculous kind of crazy confidence that exists within Westminster and Whitehall, that somehow or other they're uniquely placed to design policy options and systems without properly consulting or engaging with better experience around the world, or without actually imagining that there might be practitioners out there that know far more than they do about how to do something. Just because you've been educated in Oxford or Cambridge and some arts or humanities degree, the idea that somehow or other you can rule the world is one of the most dangerous ideas around, but it's deeply embedded in our governance system. So for me, it's about breaking that myth that somehow or other there's a unique quality to the political and administrative class within Whitehall and Westminster. If anything demonstrated that that quality is not there, then their response to this crisis demonstrates that for me. So I think addressing that would do a lot to help restore people's trust in a governance system that was actually capable of delivering and meeting their sense of fairness and equity.
Thank you, Gerry. Well, look, we've come to the end of our time together. Many thanks to Will, to Jen, and to Gerry for such a thought-provoking conversation. And many thanks to our digital partner content group for their support for this podcast series. So on behalf of Michelle and myself, goodbye for now.